I want to say a quick thanks again for the warm welcome and all the folks who made it really easy to ease my way in here. Thanks to the musicians, Mike and Yokiko, and the choir. Thanks to Jennifer for being great worship associate, and Oifi, and Reverend Ann, who I guess is not in the room anymore, but it's really lovely to be here. So we're going to talk about humanism. And let's begin with a definition, that old cliche beginning with a definition. But this is from the Humanist Manifesto, 1933. And they say, the goal of humanism is a free and universal society in which people voluntarily and intelligently cooperate for the common good. In place of the old attitudes involved in worship and prayer, the humanist finds religious emotions expressed in a heightened sense of personal life and in a cooperative effort to promote social well-being. So it's a long way from these kinds of declarations from when we began the beginning of Christian history, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to go on a long trip through time, and the historical events I'm going to talk about are just my version of the story. It's incomplete. It's frankly arbitrary, and a real historian might take exception to my version of events, but that is actually how history works. We create narratives, and hopefully they stick together. So how do we go from being a totally Christian faith tradition to having humanism become such a big part of our tradition? So Jesus the rabbi, his story begins, many, many years ago, and some people took some ideas from that, and they practiced that Christianity in small groups and in their own way for three centuries or so. And then in 325, there was a thing called the Council of Nicaea. And this was a meeting of the leaders of these small Christian groups. They called themselves bishops then, and it was in Nicaea, which is in now what is now Turkey. And what they tried to do, they wanted to be the first group to create a uniform Christian doctrine. And folks who come out of Catholicism or other certain Christian traditions will recognize this language. We believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of all things visible and invisible, the Nicene Creed. And it also established, the council established the idea of a Trinity. So Father, Son, Holy Ghost. There were only a few folks present who disagreed with that, including a bishop named Arius. And he voted against it, and for his efforts got banned to Illyria, which is sort of northern Greece. So the first dissenter, the first Unitarian was a dissenter. So the lines were drawn. Is there a Trinity or not? And there were constant arguments. And it's funny, I read a lot of Christian history in seminary, and it kind of, for the first 1,000 years or so, it just seems like one group of men, always men, quibbling with each other, saying, we have found the final, correct, perfect understanding of the divine. And this is it, until the next group of men comes along and says, we have found the final, correct, complete understanding of the divine. So this goes on for about 1,200 years. And then in 1453, there's a thing comes out called the Gutenberg Bible. And the interesting thing is that given the impact that it had, there were only about 180 copies printed. And they were mostly sold to religious communities and religious authorities. It's actually, if you get down to New York City, the J.P. Morgan Library has a copy. It's a free library. It's fantastic. You can see this thing that changed history right there in front of you. So what it did, though, is it marked a period where folks, mostly men, because only men were taught to read, were becoming literate, and they were reading the Bible for themselves. They were, instead of just being told what was in the Bible and what to believe, they were reading the Bible themselves, and literally all hell broke loose. So this is the beginning of the Reformation, and this guy, Martin Luther, in 1517, he had a lot of problems with the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was in disarray then. They were selling indulgences. They were really focused on money. Priests were more like power brokers and not very chaste or poor or particularly, pious. Anyway, so he wrote up his 95 theses, and I love his flair for the dramatic. He nails them to the door of the cathedral, and that was the beginning of the Reformation. Things are really starting to move along. So in 1553, there was a guy named Michael Servetus, who was a medical doctor from Spain, and he's one of these guys who read the Bible for himself. And he was like, hey, there is nothing in here about the Trinity. And he was very outspoken about it. And he was such a classic UU in a lot of ways. He just wouldn't shut up about it. He was banned. He had a warrant for his arrest, but he could not go to church to like hear what was wrong in church. So he would wear disguises and sit in the last row and go to but he finally got busted. He broke out at one point and then got busted. And then he was ordered burned at the stake by none other than John Calvin, Calvin was an unusually cruel guy. He actually, the typical pattern was if you were burned at the stake, this is sort of gross, but if you're burned at the stake, they would kill you first. They would stab a spear in your heart so you would not be burnt alive. And Servetus begged to be killed. He begged John Calvin to be killed before being set fire to, and Calvin wouldn't do it. So whenever I see a Wesleyan or someone who comes out of the, a religious professional who comes out of the Calvin tradition, I'm always like, your guy burned my guy. We need to talk about that. So, but what we see is this pattern of folks thinking for themselves and oftentimes suffering the consequences, taking responsibility. So in 1568, there was a thing called the Edict of Torda. There was a guy named Frederick or Francis David, depending on the translation, who was in Transylvania, which is now Hungary. And he advocated for a decree, that local religious communities could freely elect their own religious leaders. So much like we in Unitarian Universalism call and ordain our ministers, this law, he was advocating for this law that would allow religious congregations to elect their preachers. Now, it didn't allow individual religious freedom. You couldn't decide for yourself to go do your own religion, but there was some democracy, and it sanctioned this kind of, really at the time, unprecedented religious tolerance, And there's this, so I think every UU church, I guarantee somewhere in this church is this painting of the Edict of Torda, of Francis David making his plea to King Sigismund. And the king is over on one side and he's looking thoughtful and there's all these frowning, other people in the court looking at Francis David. And he's in a long robe. I wish I was in a robe for this. And he's standing there like this. And there's a beam of sun coming down from the window on him as he tells the truth about religious tolerance. There's got to be that painting somewhere in a closet in this church, right? No? Oh, man. All right. Well, check it out. But these are the folks that we can claim legitimately as our spiritual ancestors. We have a long history. We're tempted to think that this church, this faith tradition started in 1961 at the merger, but it is way, way older than that. So now let's move over to the Americas. And in 1648, there was a thing called the Cambridge Platform. So these religious rebels were migrating to the Americas and just wanted to acknowledge and pushing out the indigenous folks. And they set up, when they got there, they set up a covenant about how individual churches were going to rule themselves and relate to each other. So not just how they were going to rule themselves, but also how they were going to be together. And also within that was the beginning of separation in church and state. So the governor of the Massachusetts settlement was not automatically the head of the church. Now, that was a thing, of course, but until 1833, everybody had to pay taxes that were public taxes that also went to the church. So whether you belonged to that church or not, you were paying taxes to fund it. But it's an important document in how we think about ourselves. I was ordained by First UU in Niagara Falls. I wasn't ordained by the UUA. It was a lay leader of that congregation who said the words that ordained me. The power is bottom up in our denomination. That's a real thing. So things are moving along. In Then William Ellery Channing, the free mind guy, we just read his words in our responsive reading. He's thinking about our relationship to religion and God, and he writes in his collected works, he writes, "One of the greatest of all errors is the attempt to exalt God by making him the sole cause, the sole agent in the universe, by denying to the creature, human beings, freedom of will and moral power, by making man a mere recipient and transmitter of a foreign impulse. This, if followed out consistently, destroys all moral connection between God and his creatures. To extinguish the free will is to strike the conscience with death, for both have but one and the same life." So he's talking about the importance of free wills. "It makes the universe a machine. It freezes the fountain of our moral feelings." So, all right, so 1838, Harvard Divinity School invites this guy, Ralph Waldo Emerson, to give a sermon at the graduating class of that seminary. And man, do they regret that. So he's a transcendentalist. And, you know, transcendentalists emphasize intuition over science. They believe that individuals are capable of having completely original insights with as little attention and deference to past masters as possible. So no respect for history, which is not how the Harvard Div School worked back then. So he gets up there in front of all these new ministers, and he's talking about the core beliefs of transcendentalism. He's talking about how people are inherently good, the inherent good. And he's talking about how society and its institutions have corrupted the purity of the individual. And so in Harvard Div School at the time was the institution. And they have faith that people are at their best when truly self-reliant and independent. So, you know, so at the time when he gives the speech, Harvard's the center of academic Unitarian thought. And his comments were extremely radical, as you'd expect. And he was, you know, critiquing conventional Unitarian theology. And for good measure, he also says, by the way, we don't need to believe in the historical miracles of Jesus. So just for added benefit. So for his efforts, he was attacked as an atheist, which was a big insult at the time, and he was never invited back, of course. But the Enlightenment was happening. The Enlightenment was happening, and culture was changing with it, and with it, religion. So 1859, Charles Darwin. So Charles Darwin, we can claim Darwin as one of ours because he grew up in a Unitarian family. And one of the things about his research was he was very critical of using the Bible as history. So instead, he talked about evolution by natural selection. 1867, things are accelerating, this like departure from God is the central truth of everything, this the old dogma. 1867, the Free Religious Association is founded. And it's a collection of Quakers, of liberal Jews, Unitarians, agnostics, scientific theists. And their goal was to be a spiritual anti-slavery society and to emancipate religion from the dogmatic traditions it had been previously bound to. So it was opposed to not only organized religion, but also any supernaturalism in any form, and it was about affirming, again, the individual conscience and individual reason. So they thought, you know, we can do this. You know, we can perfect humanity. We can have a democratic faith. We believe in the worth of each individual. Do these things sound familiar compared to our seven principles? And the affirmation of reason, a free and responsible search. How about that? So the first person to sign up at the original meeting was, wait for it, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it caught on, and many FRA members helped to lead these communes that are based on these values of equality and self-organizing organizations. And I love, Hopedale and Brookhaven, is it? So, yeah, these communes out in Western Mass were some of the examples of these. And they were always great because the folks had these great ideas. They were really intellectuals and writers and readers and teachers. And they would go and we're gonna live off the land, and they'd last a few months, and then winter would come and it'd get cold and they'd be out of food because no one had bothered to farm or knew how to do it, and then they'd disassemble. So, but the ideas were fine and were great. They just were not the most practical people. So, meanwhile, the country is, again, pushing westward, pushing indigenous folks out. And there's a frontier, and with it, a sense of independence. So in 1887, there's a thing, a Western Conference of Unitarian Churches that meets in Chicago. So they're actually, they're formally formed 30 years before in 1852 by William Channing Gannett. And they were a group of churches in the Midwest, which was the frontier at the time, that wanted to be less about Christian doctrine. They were less about Christian doctrine. So they meet in 1887 in Chicago, and they write a statement of faith. And this, I love this, this title of their statement of faith: "Things most commonly believed today among us." And it's so you. They can't say, "These are the things we all believe." They're just like, "These are the most common things that we kind of agree on." And it was totally, you know, just the annual meeting of any UU church, you know. And I love it. I love it a lot. But so they say, these are the first two statements they say. They say, one, "We believe that to love the good and to live the good is the supreme thing in religion." So they're not saying God, but they're saying close to it. It's definitely a subtweet. And second, they say, "We hold reason and conscience to be the final authorities in all matters of religious beliefs." Reason and conscience are the final authorities. So not the Bible, not what the president of the American Unitarian Association says at the time. You know, we can decide for ourselves. And then we move into the 20th century. There's a guy named Reverend John Dietrich. He actually retired in 1938, and he started in the Calvinist tradition, our old friend, John Calvin. And his colleagues in Calvinism kept accusing him of being a Unitarian. So he was like, "Fine, I'll go be a Unitarian." So he left, and he started in 1916 a congregation in Minneapolis that was Unitarian and very humanist. And it was so popular that he had to move services out of his church to a theater downtown so we could have a couple thousand people at his services every Sunday. But you know, he saw humanism not as a rejection of religion, but as a shift of emphasis. He thought religion was still important, but we're going to focus, instead of focusing on the supernatural, we're going to focus on human beings. And we're, instead of focusing on the afterlife, we're going to focus on the wonders and challenges of this life. So, for more than a decade, he and another Unitarian colleague, a guy named Reverend Curtis Reese, they were preaching his humanism to their congregations. And all the Unitarians, Christian or not Christian, were having this enormous debate about the relative merits of having a strictly human-centered, scientifically-minded, ethically-focused religion. And there was a lot of strong pros going on back and forth. People were very angry. Curtis Reese puts together a periodical called Unity, and he puts out a volume called Humanist Sermons. And this is in his prelude. He writes, "Humanists did and do regard themselves as thoroughly modern, progressive, and enlightened. The time has passed, they opine, for theism and deism." The time has passed for theism. Think about how radical that is to all the Christians who are still Unitarians. They pride themselves in having dispensed the supernatural God in their religion and look forward to building a religion with man rather than God as its centerpiece. Wow. They hold that the chief end of man is to serve man. So it's quite a, it's an amazing thing that's going on, and they're getting really, really bold. And I read from the beginning that in 1933, they finally have the first humanist manifesto. And this manifesto was consciously designed to create a religious faith. So not just a philosophy of life, but, you know, a genuine faith. And it has its failings, but we want to be sure to acknowledge that this was a heartfelt attempt to join intellectual integrity with the religious feelings. So these folks were not just being cranky. They were really trying their best to do something that was going to be meaningful as times changed. So in this manifesto, as I said, they say the time has passed for theism and deism. And things go along. And by the time there's a UU Humanist Association that's founded in 1962, right after we joined together to create the UUA. And by that point, humanism was a part of the mainstream of UU. So as UU grew following World War II, a number of congregations were formed that were lay-led, that didn't have ministers. So folks were not coming out of seminaries with their ideas. And these fellowships were much more likely to be humanist. And I'm in danger here of making a sweeping generalization, but in a lot of our congregations today, our elders who are of the baby boomer generation will have humanism as the dominant theology. So not the only theology by any means, but very prominent. And there's a reason for that, I think. I see humanism as a natural response to the gap between what religion promises and our own experiences. So religious folks have always had to grapple with the idea of theodicy. Theodicy, I don't know if you've heard of this theological term. It's the question of how do you reconcile the idea of an all-powerful God with God being benevolent? So if God is all-powerful, how is it possible that there is so much suffering? How can they let innocent people suffer? How can God let innocent people suffer? That's a real question that every religion struggles with, if it's serious, you know. And that thinking also really did not slow down in the 20th century after the Holocaust and nuclear warfare. It's a real question. So what are we to make of this history that we've had from the Council of Nicaea to here? So for me, at the heart of this story is this constant cry, let me decide for myself, let us decide for ourselves. And that's our fourth principle. You know, we have a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And by the early 20th century, the establishment folks of Unitarianism had a real insurrection on their hands with all these humanists in the Midwest. And they had to, there was this moment of truth, I love this. They had to ask themselves, do we really mean what we say when we say we're non-creedal? Can we really live with this way that folks are listening to their consciences? It's a genuine difference in belief. And to me, it's a profound demonstration of integrity that they said, yes, yes, we can live with this. It's amazing that Unitarianism could embrace humanism without a schism, without a huge sect, you know, breaking off to form their own religion, like so many Christian sects have done. You know, the United Methodist Church is going to have a split soon, I imagine, over the recent decision. Like, you know, churches breaking up is the reality. And somehow, the Christian establishment of Unitarianism found the extraordinary grace and generosity to expand the circle of Unitarianism to include humanism. We missed that split. And let's give credit to the humanists. It could have dissolved into individualism, but it didn't. All these folks who are humanists could say, well, I'm taking my beliefs and never going to church again. And let's be real, that was a time when a lot of folks were, you know, a lot of folks in mainline denominations were just giving up on church. But the humanists still saw the value of religious communities. Our president, Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, says, at heart, we must remember that we are primarily, first and foremost, religious communities. So this practice of integrity, of really meaning it when we say we're truly allowing freedom of conscience, that's still going on. So now many of our congregations have folks practicing earth-centered traditions like paganism and Wiccan. And this is more a matter of identity than theology, but now it's the norm to be welcoming. It's the expectation that we're welcoming to folks from the LGBTQ community. And this never gets said enough, but in the 70s and 80s, it was women who transformed our tradition. It was women who led the way on creating the seven principles and who changed the hymns that we sing. And, you know, back then, I mean, I'm proud to say this now, but back then it wasn't the case. But now, more than half of UU ministers identify as women, and somewhere between a quarter and a third are LGBTQ identified. And I'm so proud of that. That's just awesome. So now, and this is going on. Our tradition is now doing the difficult work of consciously addressing our white supremacy. so we can be even more truly welcoming. And the funny thing, this is really funny, we've come around to the point where in some churches, now it's the folks who are Christian who feel like they're on the outside and they're asking to be welcomed in. Isn't that something? How ironical, as some of my friends say. So it reminds me of there's a short poem by a guy named Edward Markham, who's a universalist. It's called Outwitted. The poem goes like this. He drew a circle that shut me out. Heretic, a rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in. So I'll close today by saying that unlike the early Christian theologians who kept establishing doctrines that were meant to be the final answer, today our UU religion continues to be open to learning and to evolving. And as we evolve, my prayer is that we continue that spirit of generosity and welcome, that as we hold to our core principles, we also draw the circle wider and encounter our differences with curiosity and compassion. May it be so. Amen, and blessed be.